Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and this is my co-host and colleague, Sam.
Sam Wong here, professor of neuroscience and founder of the Princeton Election Consortium, and for today, the Princeton Gerrymandering Project.
Very important. Happy New Year. This is our first recording in 2018.
Happy New Year.
And big news on our end is you can now get the podcast on Spotify.
Yes.
Under WooCast's Politics and Polls, and I think they have every episode up already.
So, oh, good.
Yeah,
oh,
we're good. Excited right. About that.
Okay.
So this is a late breaking news episode, if we have that. We decided that we have to discuss what happened recently. Big news on the redistricting front for those who follow and for everyone who feels the impact of redistricting, which includes the whole country. For those who follow, a three-judge federal panel ruled that the congressional map in North Carolina was unconstitutional. The decision was unanimous among the three judges who had been appointed by Carter, Obama, and George W. Bush. And they said that the lines were drawn to ensure the Republican domination of the state's delegation. Because they were drawn with those political motivations, it was struck down. This is big news. The courts have been reluctant to enter into what was once called the political thicket by the Warren Court. And Justice Roberts has continued to indicate some hesitation about the courts taking this on, even though the Supreme Court is considering this issue. And I anticipate this case will reach the Supreme Court. But here we have talked now since this podcast started, given all your work, about the importance of redistricting, the way in which changes in redistricting because of computer technology, because of aggressive moves by the Republicans since 2010, has really hardened the lines of partisan domination. And the courts are finally at least considering this. In this case, have done something pretty dramatic, from my understanding, said that this kind of partisan gerrymandering can't stand. And I think that throws open a lot of questions. And that's why I'm excited to talk to you about it, because you're the expert on this, and help us walk through this case. So maybe we can just start, Sam, by explaining, if you can explain a little bit about what the justices said about the North Carolina congressional districting.
Right. So there are some, Julian, there are some pretty important features of this case, and you have already said some of them. It is notable that it's a unanimous decision. Let me back up and say that this is the first time ever that a statewide districting map has been struck down for reason of extreme partisanship, of excessive partisanship. It's people, reformers, litigants have been trying to do this now for about 30 years since this case called Davis versus Bandemer concerning the Indiana State Legislature back in 1986. And it's just been one time up at bat over and over again, and over and over again, people have whiffed. And so for litigants to succeed in doing this, that's a big deal. For the decision to be unanimous, and as you pointed out, judges appointed by members of both major parties. And so that was interesting. The Bush appointee had some concerns about the constitutionality of some of the claims made by the litigants, but he put those off in a concurrence with a partial dissent. I forget what it was called, but basically there are a few points that are mainly of interest to, I think, constitutional scholars. Important differences, but these are likely to get resolved. And so the other important feature of this case is that it's a very well put together decision. To a redistricting nerd, it's like pig heaven going through this 200-page decision, because it's got all these details that show that the judges really did their homework. They looked into it. They thought about the evidence. They gathered up, or they considered, a variety of statistical evidence, some map-based evidence, and they did it in advance of the Supreme Court. So the fact that the Supreme Court has two cases, as of this fall, they had one case, Gill versus Whitford, that they heard, and we've all been waiting in this community, waiting for that decision to come out. And then a few weeks ago, they up and said, well, they decided to take a second redistricting case, and that second case is in Maryland, where the gerrymander is committed by Democrats. And so now, already on the Supreme Court's docket, there are two cases, a Republican gerrymander and a Democratic gerrymander. And there's been a lot of tea leaf reading in that community trying to figure out why did they take a second case. And so one thing that's important about this lower court's decision is the decision is very well put together from a technical point of view, very well done, a lot of craftsmanship, a lot of hard constitutional thinking. And now there's this 200-page decision that's available to the Supreme Court. You know, maybe it'll shape their thinking. Maybe they've got their own thoughts on the issue. Surely they do. But having something like this in advance is in some ways, at least to my thinking, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but it looks to me like it's a good template for the Supreme Court to look at and to take into consideration. And sure, it's going to go to them. And then there's a question of, you know, but they may do something with it before then because, as I said, they've got these two other cases that are in front of it in line right now.
And do you think that this case and this very detailed reading you're talking about answers any of the concerns that Justice Roberts has raised about they're going to get endless number of cases if they start dealing with this? It will undermine the integrity of the court. Does this case not only outline the problem of partisan gerrymandering, but answer some of the traditional questions? What do you think?
I think there are a few things going on here that are important. So let's start with the constitutional theory. These three judges were all favorable to the idea that partisan gerrymandering is a violation of the 14th Amendment, the principle that one person should have one vote. And all three of the judges agreed that that was an important standard. They did not fully agree on two other principles that have been brought up in court cases. And that's probably going to be something that that may inform the Supreme Court. One is this minority judge, the Bush appointee, if I'm reading correctly, was a bit skeptical about the First Amendment claim, which is viewpoint discrimination, where you get retaliated against on account of your political views. Mm-hmm. And he thought that that was in some way that I don't quite understand quite yet, is opening up the way to too many lawsuits. And I think one concern. There's a couple of concerns that Roberts has expressed, and if we take him at his word, one concern is that they will be flooded with lawsuits.
Right.
Now, if that's the case, I think this case in North Carolina may help a little bit because they brought up different kinds of evidence. One kind of evidence is a simple mathematical measure that a political scientist, Eric McGee, came up with a few years ago called the efficiency gap. They cited another kind of statistical evidence that I've written about in the Stanford Law Review, and that's the difference between the average vote in a state and the median district. And if the median vote and the average vote get too far apart from each other, then you have a whole bunch of districts that are above average, sort of a Lake Wobegon effect. And that mean median difference is also something that's 100 years old as a statistic. So it was invented by Carl Pearson 100 years ago. So they go over these different kinds of evidence. And so that's one part of it.
And what the idea of that, just so people understand, is that so the courts always say, how are we going to decide?
Right.
Because it will be just as arbitrary. Right. You're saying with all of these methods that here are ways that you can rationally and objectively look at the districts and say, do they fit within a certain criteria? If they don't,
right.
You have
exactly. So I would say that when Roberts in oral argument in Whitford fretted about, he said, if we have a mathematical formula that we use to decide these things, what are people going to say? And you know, my immediate reaction is what they're going to say, dude, is that you have an objective standard. That's what they're going to say. Now, from a judge's point of view, I think his reaction would be, ew, you want me to use math and let the math decide? And I think what this lower court did was they showed a path to how one could do that. And they considered all the evidence in an intelligent way. They, as I said, the efficiency gap and the mean median difference, you can just do these in a spreadsheet program. You can do them. They're simple enough. You can do them with a pencil and paper. They considered maps that were drawn by an expert where the expert drew a whole bunch of different maps and said, well, here's the range of possibilities, and this actual map is quite extreme over the entire range. One of the concerns, I think, if I understand correctly, is the question of intent. And the question is, was partisanship the predominant intent? Was it the only intent? And there was some back and forth between the majority and minority opinions on the court as to how to measure intent. And if I read correctly, actually the minority opinion from the Bush appointee suggests that what the standard ought to be simply that there was predominant intent, but not that it was the only intent. And that seems to me like a pretty smart standard, predominant, but not the only intent. Not the only motivation.
But the math won't help you with the intent. So the math helps with the effect.
Yeah, it's a mix of things. So basically, the judges did a really good job of going – they did the whole thing. Okay,
yeah.
So they did the intents. They talked about partisan motivations. In some ways, it was an easy case in terms of partisan motivation because it turns out the North Carolina redistrictors, the Republicans in charge, were upfront about it. They said, okay, we're not supposed to do a racial gerrymander. So we're going to do this, and we're just going to tell everybody explicitly – we're doing a partisan gerrymander. And the reason
they said this in public?
Yeah. And one of the legislators said, the only reason we're drawing it to be 10 Republicans and 3 Democrats is that I can't think of a way to make it 11 Republicans and 2 Democrats. Now, with better redistricting technology, it would be possible to get 11 too. And so I'm pretty sure it would be possible to squeeze even one more seat out of it. So the thing is, it was a slam dunk in terms of partisan intent because that part was made easy for the judges. And so that actually might create a problem in the future because if it's only cases like North Carolina where the ambitions are nakedly expressed, that might be a problem in the future. And so I think that's something that that courts will have to deal with, specifically the Supreme Court. Because I think in most cases, intentions are considered.
You have to look at statements.
I don't think it would be hard. I think you could do it objectively. You say, was there one party in charge?
Right.
Was the other party either frozen out of the process or were individual legislators on the other side bought off with promises that one of the few safe seats would belong to them? Because you can imagine, if you got a 10-3 map of 10 Republicans, 3 Democrats, you just go to those 3 Democrats and say, okay, if you have any say over the process, if you'll go along with it, then we'll get a few of you. And so then you can imagine picking off members of the opposition. This happened in Texas back in 2004, I think, where Hispanic Democrats were picked off by the Texas Republican majority. And the Supreme Court had trouble with that because Justice Kennedy, I believe, thought that was evidence that both parties participated. But what it was really evidence of was that the state party was on one side was able to pick off individual legislators on the other side.
And is North Carolina's districting, beyond the fact that you have statements about why they drew the districts this way, is it more egregious than other states? Or is this, if you look, you'll find comparable activity in other states?
The way I would put it is that currently North Carolina's gerrymander in its congressional map is one of the worst in the last 40 years and maybe the worst ever.
Ever.
Yeah. Now, that having been said, there are a few caveats. One is that it's only really fair to compare with gerrymanders over the last 50 years because that's how long districts have had to be of equal size.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is that actually it turns out that it's pretty bad, but it's in basically a five-way tie, where there's other bad gerrymanders in the United States right now. Pennsylvania's bad, Ohio's bad, Michigan's bad. And so there are other states that are equally egregious. It just so happens that partisan gerrymandering has gone through the roof in the last 20 years, where there used to be maybe one bad partisan gerrymander per decade. Like Democrats committed a real doozy of one in the 1980s where the political boss Phil Burton oversaw
– this is in California.
In California, oversaw a map that basically nabbed 5 seats for the Democrats in California. There used to be like maybe one bad offense per decade. And in the 2000s, there were 5 of them. In this current cycle, there were 6 or 7 of them. And so basically, there's this giant loophole in the American system that just came wide open after the wave election of 2010. And mostly Republicans in Maryland, the Democrats, they just went right through it. And so, North Carolina is a really bad one. Democrats have also gerrymandered North Carolina in the past. So they had a gerrymander 10 years ago, which was also a pretty bad gerrymander. And so, North Carolina is no stranger to this partisan warfare. And now there's a chance to maybe put guardrails on it and bring it to a stop.
Right. So the case has – so we've always had partisan gerrymandering. And so one thing the court has to do is agree – the Supreme Court has to agree this is something that the courts legitimately can deal with.
Yeah.
Either because there's formulas to correct it or see when problems exist or because for democracy, it's essential. And the second is that it's actually getting significantly worse since 2010 because of computer technology and everything. So there, it's a kind of moment of crisis or a state of crisis.
Yeah. So I'd say circa—
it's not like it always was.
No, I'd say back in 2004, 2006, when Kennedy weighed in, he was on the fence and he was a little bit thumb-sucking about it and said, well, you know, there's not a clear standard. And since he said that, the gates opened up. And there was a lot of gerrymandering that was done, probably partly because there was a recognition that the Supreme Court was appeared to be unlikely to do anything. And so the floodgates opened. And so that indecision on his part, which, you know, might have been well conceived, opened up the way to more and more extreme gerrymanders. And so now the offenses are quite bad. And there's and at this point, I'd say the distortion to representation nationwide total is worse now than it's been in the age of one person, one vote. Ballpark, seems like about a dozen seats are pushed over to be secure for one party and not the other that would otherwise be more competitive. And so a dozen seats is a lot. In the current Congress, a dozen seats makes a big difference. I think that if these gerrymanders could be undone, it's, you know, it's already, it already looks like Democrats are probably going to retake the House in November. You know, we'll see, but it looks looking pretty good. But imagine the fact that they're doing this against a headwind where they are fighting from being 12 seats down in the absence of any elections. They're just, the 12 seats are lost to them. And imagine if that advantage were undone. And, you know, Republicans, I was on CNN pretty recently and there was this guy, Mark Shields, who was on, and he was going off about one particular gerrymander in Illinois, and he was holding that up as an example of how both sides do it. But, you know, it is possible to identify cherry-picked examples of the worst offenses of the last 40 years, but the notable fact about them is there used to be about one per decade.
Yeah.
And now we've got seven of them at once. And so there's something qualitatively worse that is, I think, profoundly disruptive to democracy. And, you know, the Supreme Court looks like they're poised to deal with it.
I want to pick up on that in a second.
Yeah.
But, and so I'll go back to North Carolina in another question. But you do – now this has become a full-time – not a full-time, but it's been a – it's a part of your portfolio.
Oh, it's a serious
activity.
With
the gerrymandering project, which a major project. People are looking at it, meaning justices are actually looking at what you're doing.
I hope so.
And what do you say to people when I've written about gerrymandering a little bit and often people's eyes glaze over?
Yes.
They're either cynical. They're like, you know, the no kidding response.
Yeah.
Or they're like, I don't get why this matters.
What
do you say to people?
Right. So, for instance, like I was on when I was on TV, I was on with this this leader of racial justice in North Carolina, Reverend William Barber. And he, like many African Americans who are very concerned about representation, was focused on voting rights, focused on voter suppression. And these are issues of obvious importance to people in that community and in any community that's had historic problems in representation. Gerrymandering sounds dry. Mm-hmm. It sounds like something only a nerd would love. But it's an offense that takes away your it doesn't take away your right to vote. It takes away you having someone to vote for. And so he can do all the activism he wants. He can get every African American of voting age in North Carolina registered and get them all out to vote. But if they're all packed into three districts, then that means that they only have those candidates they can vote for. And that means that in the case of North Carolina, there's two or three districts worth of people who never have the chance to have their own representation. Right. And so the issue there is that it sounds dry, but it takes away having someone to vote for because your legislators chose you and packed you into a district where they could keep you all in one place. And so, yeah, it's obscure. But as far as I can tell, it's absolutely central to how we conduct ourselves as a democracy.
It was a huge issue in the 50s and 60s, the civil rights movement. Leaders you've read about, local leaders often talked about the way districts were packed to favor rural areas over urban areas, which culminates in the one man, one vote rulings from the Supreme Court. And it's always notable when I look back at how they took these process issues and rules issues, the movement, very seriously because of what you're saying. They understood if you didn't change that, the political dynamics in the states or in Congress was never going to change. So it was essential to break the power of rural machine bosses, essentially.
I think people take this kind of thing for granted and treat it as being a little bit obscure because, you know, on an everyday basis, the thing that we can do is go vote. We usually, most of us do not have the opportunity to change the rules of the game.
Yeah.
So I just turn on my TV or my newsfeed or what have you, and I discover that there's something happening in a swing state like Ohio or Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Why do we have swing states?
Right.
We have swing states because of the Electoral College.
That's a good point.
And we have the Electoral College because slave owners in Virginia wanted to vote on behalf of the human beings who they owned.
Yeah.
That's why we have – so that Virginia plantation owner is why we have – whatever, Rust Belt voters in Pennsylvania becoming so important. And so, yeah, these things do seem obscure, and rules fights seem obscure. But look, the Sanders people were interested in reforming the Democratic Party. Other people are interested in reforming the Electoral College. You'll have people, you know, smart people are trying to figure out, you know, how the FEC should be run or mm-hmm. how nominations to the Supreme Court run. Like, can we block Merrick Garland from being on the Supreme Court? Can we... if you're a Democrat, if you're the Obama administration, can we bend the rules for how a federal agency is run? Mm-hmm. Right? Rules matter.
Rules matter
and
a
it's
lot.
Just, and,
it's
you
the
know,
fundamentals in politics.
And I mean, look, I'm yeah. like you say, like I just it's part of my research portfolio at this point. But like what? Like what if people who are interested in this rules reform, whether they're activists or whether they're professors and researchers or whether they're lawyers, what if that community of people could do something that would make the playing field more level and move not just these 12 seats that went into one column and not the other, but all the districts surrounding them. Like something like 100 districts are not competitive or less competitive than they would be otherwise. What if a ragtag band of nerds was able to make that 100 seats more competitive?
A mathematics revolution.
Surely that would be good for democracy.
Yeah, and it is really interesting just as an observer to see the mathematics part, which is why I asked before as a potential solution,
yeah.
which is obviously not what you usually associate with revolutionary political activity or reform, it actually is quite important. But back to North Carolina.
Yes, North Carolina.
So the court made this decision, historic decision. They laid out a pretty comprehensive document that the Supreme Court will probably look at and could be the basis of a new kind of decision. What happens in North Carolina right now between now and 2018?
Right. So what happens right now is that there is an order given that the North Carolina legislature should redraw the map and come up with a new one in the next couple of weeks. The deadline is before the end of January. And that legislature could do it, or they could drag their heels or do a lousy job or what have you. And if they do a lousy job, then a special master will be appointed to do the job. And that special master, you know, could be – it could be the same special master who redrew the state legislative districts in North Carolina, this guy at Stanford, Nate Persily. So it could be him, could be somebody else. And so, you know, if the North Carolina legislature doesn't show good faith effort, then it's going to go to a special master. The one thing that could happen right now is that the Supreme Court could issue a stay, because sometimes when there's a relevant case, they'll say, why don't you hold off on that? Don't implement that, because the implementation of that may depend on something we're doing right now. And so sometimes the Supreme Court will issue a stay.
And so then it's these districts are frozen
so,
in place.
So because these two cases are being considered by the Supremes right now, I think that like if there's no stay – let's see. So if there's a stay, it means that everything I just said is inoperative and they all have to wait and it's hang time until the Supreme Court sorts out the two cases they're looking at. If the Supreme Court does not issue a stay, then everything goes forward as I described. And there's a second thing going on in the tea leaves there. If the Supreme Court doesn't issue a stay in this North Carolina case, it sends a big bat signal about what they're going to do with the two cases they have. Because if they're not going to issue a stay, what they're saying is, it's going to go against you guys. So why don't you just get on the bus and ride the bus.
Get started now.
You know, ride the bus like we told you to, like they told you
to.
And so I think that if they don't issue a stay in the next 2 weeks, that is highly telling. If they do issue a stay, it's a little bit more ambiguous.
So we have no idea when we'll hear from the Supreme Court.
I thought it could have been as early as February or March, but it was pointed out to me by some lawyers that the deadline for briefs in the Maryland case is in late January.
Okay.
And so therefore, they would have to file those briefs and then have oral argument in March. And it would be really unfair to them to do that and then to have the decision in the Wisconsin case come and be something that they didn't know about when they were preparing their case. And so simply for grounds of fairness and procedure, it's more likely the case, it's more likely the situation that the Supreme Court is going to hear the Maryland case in March, which is when it's likely to be scheduled for, and then write both decisions over time and then release them at some point towards the end of the term, maybe May or June.
So it's still unlikely that even if for some reason the Supreme Court does a dramatic move and rules a little bit like the North Carolina court, it's unclear if it will affect the 2018 midterm election.
That is unclear.
In a big way.
Right, because the thing is, if you think about June to November, right, it is that's just not a long time. So first you have to have primaries.
Right.
Then you have to have the general election. Like, that's tough. One could imagine it, but it's a really foreshortened timescale. So that really changes the question of whether there can be anything in effect by November. I would say if I were a betting man, what I would say is that it's pretty likely that North Carolina's map will have to be redrawn in time for November. I think, I'm not sure. And that would be about three seats that would be more or less moved over from Republican to toss up. And then the other cases, Maryland. I mean, Maryland, really, the Democrats stole one seat there. And so I would say that the question in the balance is whether what's going to happen to the 6th district in Maryland, because it's really that one district. All the districts are more skewed than they really have to be in Maryland. But that one is the one that they would otherwise not have. And so that's I'd say that's at stake.
So it's really if things move in a direction that happened this week, it would really be by 2020 presidential and congressional elections where you could see all of a sudden the house is thrown open in a way it hasn't been in a long time.
Yeah, you can imagine, as I said before, close to 100 seats more competitive.
That's unbelievable.
And about a dozen seats shifted over one way. Now, that having been said, partisanship in America is still strong. And underlying all of this, partisanship doesn't go away. All the stuff that you see about people getting heated up about whatever partisan issue they care about, all that disease in American politics is still there. Voters' hearts have not been.
And there's a lot of political scientists like Nolan McCarty, who's one of our colleagues here, who says it's important not to overstate redistricting as the source of partisanship.
Yeah.
He'll say the Senate's become more partisan. He argues, all these other parts of the system are equally intensifying.
Yeah, I would say that
you don't agree with that.
I agree with that statement. I think it is the case that polarization is a fuel that makes gerrymandering possible.
Yeah.
And gerrymandering is leverage that makes polarization more powerful. So I think those things are true, because in a gerrymandered district, the primary election is the only one that matters.
Yeah.
And so I think there are ways in which polarization is really the root sin, the root cause that then leads to gerrymandering being a worse problem than it used to be.
Right.
That having been said, if the house is burning, then the person who's standing by the side of the fire says, the real reason for this is that you didn't address that fire hazard.
Uh-huh.
Okay, the guy who says that is not making a whole lot of friends. Sometimes the house is on fire and you just got to get a bucket and put out the fire.
Right. Okay, back to North Carolina.
Yes.
So now, here's another question I was wondering about. So the court has – so you and many other people have been pushing mathematical formulas to determine when we have a problem and how to address a problem.
Yeah.
Here is one court that has now said there's something there. This might be part of the answer to the thicket problem. Is there, and you've mentioned several people working on how to deal with this, is there general consensus on what these formulas should be, or do you guys have a lot of divisions?
I wouldn't call it division, but I would say that there's been, as they say in the academic world, anytime someone in academic life says there's been a lot of activity in the field, sometimes this is code for we formed a circular firing line and we're ready to kill each other.
Okay.
But in this case, I would say genuinely
that
there's actually been a lot of activity in the field. So people have been looking for ways to measure these inequities for a long time. Gary King started doing it several decades ago. The plaintiffs in Wisconsin included an expert who invented a thing called the efficiency gap. I would say right now that there are ballpark about half a dozen different ways to measure it. And I think that what's probably going to happen is that it's an opportunity as cases go forward in the future for litigants to think about exactly what it is they'd like to measure. And I think a big question going forward is, okay, we got a toolbox of stuff here that political scientists and statisticians have been giving us, have offered us. Now we have to figure out, you know, what are these, you know, it's kind of like when you open up your toolbox and you see some funny tool and you say, what does that thing do? And, you know, because a good toolbox is going to have crazy tools in it. And so basically what's been provided to judges and lawyers is a toolbox. And the question is, you know, what are these tools good for? So like take North Carolina. If you look at the three Democratic seats in North Carolina, the average win in those districts was about, I believe, 68 or 69%. Pretty lopsided wins. Okay. The average win among the Republican seats is about 60%. So that's a 9-point difference. Also a safe win, but a smaller win. And so what you can see there, because the average is bigger on one side or the other, on the Democratic side, that average is higher because somebody took the trouble of taking voters and stuffing them in there so that they were all packed into the same districts. And so just comparing those two averages, you know, that's easy to do.
But there's no risk. So here's what I'm thinking. Yeah. If you guys don't agree, right? So if there are serious divisions, won't it undermine some of the ability to persuade a court or legislators? This is going to help us because they'll say it's like economists. I have 10 of them. They're all telling me different things.
So I think the difficulty is expert witnesses can disagree and then they can start throwing mud at each other. And I think that is difficult. I think if it goes in that direction and academics love to do that kind of thing, then I think that could be really bad for reform efforts. But another way to look at it would be to use the toolbox analogy saying like, look, you know, we all agree that something has to get built. And so I think that the Phillips head is the right tool for this, and I want to use Phillips head screws. And you over there think that flathead is important, and then somebody over there wants to, like, use nails. And so it's a little bit more like the fact that there's a toolbox available and figuring out which tools to use. My own take on
and
that.
Who's figuring that out? So if a justice is asking you, well, all right, we have the case. Do we figure out which tool to use?
So ultimately – the judge says, I'll be the judge of that, but I'll tell you something I'm working on right now. I'm currently working on an article for Vox, the Ezra Klein's online magazine, newspaper, or whatever, news organ, to review all the different standards. Yeah. I'm also working on a law review article in which the idea is to just look at the standards and just take the attitude is of it's a toolbox, and somebody's got to explain to you what the tools are for. And my own attitude about this is, my own point of view is that the best situation would be one in which the judge does not feel afraid of the tools and is willing to pick up the tool and try it out, right? So a screwdriver, anybody can use a screwdriver. On the other hand, like a lathe, okay, that's a crazy tool. Like I cannot use a lathe myself. And so like I would be afraid to touch a lathe. And so the issue, as far as I can tell, is partly making the tools less scary to a judge. And my feeling is hammers and screwdrivers are going to do the job here. And there are people in this domain who are very clever and who have the equivalent of a lathe, and you know they're going to offer those. So I think that there is some shaking out that has to happen at the level of expert knowledge, and that one way that can be addressed is to basically put it in the hands of the judges so they don't need experts anymore. That would be my idea of a good time.
Do you work on this part of the problem? Meaning, do you work not only on producing the knowledge that's necessary to deal with the issue, but thinking about how will it actually work and what are the best ways to organize this knowledge so it would be useful to courts and legislators?
As you pointed out, I have a research program to do this, and I have people who are working on translating this knowledge into specific analysis of Pennsylvania, of Michigan, of Ohio, to figure out what went wrong, to figure out how extreme things are, and to do some legislative analysis to illustrate how could reform get a better outcome. We're doing large-scale simulations of maps to say, okay, well, can we learn something from the map drawing process to learn what the ranges of bad acts that are possible? And so, again, to help people understand that a little bit. I'm engaged in that kind of effort because I think it's important at this point to bridge the gap. There's the map drawing nerd community. They have their own thing that they do that's very technical. There's the legal community, and they're expert and technical in their own way. And there's activists who just want to fix things, and they have simple ideas that are extremely good-hearted but not always right. And so there needs to be somebody who can communicate with all these domains. And I think that, you know, it's a big challenge to translate everything in a way that everyone's on the same page. And, you know, ideally I'd like to be academic enough to be rigorous, but bridging enough to be useful to these communities.
And this is probably the biggest moment you've had where you can imagine this actually not just coming together on your end, but having the kind of influence you were hoping for.
I think that at this point, there's going to be a coalescence of factors. This decision this week was big. And I think that it, you know, we'll see. There could be surprises along the way. But it sure looks like a major step forward.
What happens if Kennedy retires?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, at this point, he's hired his clerks for next year, so it looks like he's almost certainly going to be on the court for a year and a few months.
So it'll cover this case.
And the other thing is that if enough of a consensus is built, judges are loath to undo past decisions capriciously. And I think, I wonder whether taking the Maryland case was part of building credibility to come up with bipartisan standards that affect both parties, and maybe to get John Roberts to feel more comfortable with the whole thing. And so, you know, I mean, hypothetically, this is rank speculation.
Yeah.
Maybe one reason for taking the Maryland case was to build bipartisan credibility both ways, and to maybe even get John Roberts' vote. I mean, that would be a mitzvah, okay, uh-huh. to have John
yeah.
Roberts. But imagine having a 6-3 decision on this.
Right.
That, I think, would be a real positive for people who want reform in this area.
And can you see any unanticipated effects or challenges that you're not – obviously, if they're unanticipated, you can't see them yet. But
Hidden landmines.
I mean, partisanship is powerful. And if the court makes this ruling and you put these standards in effect, you could imagine the parties are going to quickly try to figure.
Are
there hidden landmines that you can see already?
The question is whether these standards can be gamed. And I have a contest that I ran with my readers where I said, attempt to game the following standards. And I got some entries. And actually, I'm still trying to figure out what to do with those entries because, you know.
So what are some of the.
It turns out that it's possible to game some of these tests by, say, making a pattern of districts for your own side that's widely distributed enough that the whole thing looks kind of natural. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like they say in crime, make it look like an accident. And so, you know, can you use, if you have just one standard, can you make it look like an accident? And so I think that one, like for instance, the efficiency gap, which is offered in Wisconsin, it turns out that it can be gamed. The way you game it is by making seats that are super safe for both sides. And so that's a kind of gerrymander that it doesn't address. I mean, it's not a major problem, but you know, it's the kind of thing that's still possible. And so at some level, it might be a good idea to have multiple standards that are not fully agreed upon because it makes the whole system a little bit more robust. But I would say gaming the standards is going to be one of the unanticipated consequences.
And then you feel pretty confident, not simply in terms of how parties might be able to game the system, but this will provide a better system of districting than what we have.
I'm pretty sure it will. I think that one danger is that some people might take it the wrong way and say, okay, we've solved the problem now. So an unanticipated consequence might be takes the wind out of the sails of activists and individual states. I don't think that's going to happen. Feels to me like this is gerrymandering's year. This is a good year for fixing bugs in democracy because a lot of people are aware for obvious reasons that there are some flaws that are finally coming to the fore, and our rickety democracy is creaking, and it's creaking some more. And you know, it's one thing to have a house be creaky, but when a whole part of the house falls down, oh geez, got to fix that. And so I think that there's a lot of energy for reform, and my take on it, my intuition is that getting something achieved at the level of courts is probably going to energize reformers in the civic space.
I can't imagine what incumbents would do if this happened. I'm trying to imagine the politics of if the Supreme Court says, we agree, everyone's changing their districts if they're failing.
It's not so clear that incumbents are going to hate this because, you know, there is a lot of uncertainty in redistricting. Like, there's all kinds of vindictive stuff that can happen even within a party. You can take somebody's district and I heard Gary King once from Harvard talking about
– He's a political scientist.
A political scientist who's a leader in this domain, talking about how one legislator was – moaning about how he used to be able to drop off his kid, take his wife to work, and do some other stuff all in his district. And he got redistricted so that all those things are outside his district. And he was of the opinion that it had been done to him on purpose. And speaking as a voter, you know, one's feeling is like, look, dude, you still have a safe district. I think you should be grateful for that.
And they don't lose the power of incumbency, meaning the name.
Right. So,
and
but his, you know, this legislator's point of view is that he still felt victim to the vagaries of redistricting.
Yeah.
And I think that there is, you know, played the right way, I think there could be some security to legislators to not have to be looking over their shoulder at a partisan process. And so I think that, you know, ballpark 25 years from now, if districting in the United States becomes more fair, that would be awesome. I mean, you know, we'll see.
So you're pretty optimistic that Everyone always asks, like, if you're doing media, you know, if you're betting on this, what do you think's going to happen? Which is always the worst question to get.
I'm going to ask
that to you.
Kennedy's going to rule for the plaintiffs in both the Republican gerrymander and the Democratic gerrymander. This North Carolina case might or might not get stayed, but in the end, it'll probably mostly get upheld. And at that point, there'll be more lawsuits in other states, probably not in time for the 2020 election, but certainly everyone will be on notice that it's going to be much harder to gerrymander after the next census.
We're almost out of time, but if this court ruling, if the Supreme Court agrees and the changes start, what would your next contribution be? What would your next focus be to make sure this works?
I think drilling down and starting to do deep analysis of individual states, where I've been kind of a theorist about this, where I write about all the states at once, but I think it's time to go from being a theorist to getting into the weeds and to start asking, well, how would one implement a fair process in Pennsylvania? What's a set of rules that would give a fair outcome in Pennsylvania? What's a set of rules that would be better in Ohio? Should we prioritize compactness or county boundaries? Right. Yeah. So imagining that kind of thing. So I think that that's a space where it's possible to make a contribution. And, you know, like, I mean, having issued my confident sounding prediction, you know, there's also the question of being ready for the converse outcome.
Yeah.
Because we don't know anything.
Right.
You know, what if Anthony Kennedy slips on a banana peel? What if Anthony Kennedy turns out that he's had some second thoughts and he suddenly realizes that, no, this is just a misbegotten thicket?
Yeah.
Right. So one can imagine other outcomes. I think the principal outcome to be prepared for at this point is getting into the trenches and having to deal with states one by one and coming up with ways to help people. And, you know, I should say gerrymandering doesn't affect just states. School districts can be gerrymandered, right? You can draw a school district to, like, keep out a whole bunch of people who are in a different economic or racial class from your own group. It is possible to gerrymander school districts. And
so this case can have ramifications for that kind of district.
I'm no constitutional lawyer, but I think that one could imagine
some kind of,
that it would end up being influential. Because, you know, people think of gerrymandering as being obscure. But, you know, if it affects where your kid can go to school, then it literally hits you where you live.
Yeah, you know, this is fun. This is an example of, with all the chaos and sound and fury,
Fire and fury.
A lot of stories just get buried. And obviously you didn't miss the story and I didn't miss it, but I don't think it you know, gets the kind of attention that it should. It probably wouldn't even if President Trump wasn't the president, but it's so important to what's going to happen in terms of our democracy, in terms of partisan politics. That was a really big piece of news.
It was big.
So thank you for walking us through it.
Pleasure.
And that wraps up our episode. Once again, Sam and I can now be found on Spotify. WooCast Politics and Polls are there. And you can listen wherever you go and easily access the podcast. So we're thrilled about that. Thanks for joining us. And we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Bye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.